So we'll do a few little prayers first, yes? What are we going to do? Just say the prayers.
Shakyamuni Buddha's mantra three times.
Right.
And then the four immeasurables in English and then in Tibetan.
Okay, that's it?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right.
So if you turn to the white prayer book, if you're sitting in the chair, it's the book behind your chair, on the back of your chair. And if you're sitting at the pew, it's at the end of the pew. And it's the first bay sheet where it says Kadampa Center Prayers.
And basically this is the in Sanskrit, the syllables that relate to the Buddha. Here, this is the Buddha from this one. It's a Sanskrit syllable. And the way the Buddhists would talk is that by just every word we say, every thought we have, kind of leaves an imprint in our mind, you know. So by saying positive things, you make your mind positive. By saying negative things, you make your mind negative. So by saying words that relate to, say, you know, the Buddha or holy beings, leaves a good imprint in the mind. So there's some benefit to ourself for doing this. And then the second little one, which is called the Four Immeasurables, is stating these marvelous thoughts. May all beings be not suffering. May all beings have happiness. Such positive, positive thoughts. Okay.
Taya ta om mune mune sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Sentientam chede Wadong De mention, asks us to say mantras, and they're at the bottom of the pink sheet, the Green Taurus Mantra and Chenrezig Mantra. So let's start with 8 Chenrezig Mantras.
So the Chenrezig is, as someone, Lama Zopa translates, it's compassionate eyed one. It's the representation of one of the enlightened, like enlightened energy, and it's the representation of compassion and loving kindness. And then you could say the other one, Tara, is a female one, and that's the quality of action, success, cutting through the obstacles, making things happen. We need compassion, we need wisdom, and we need the power to do, the power to act. So Chenrezig is compassion and Tara is action.
Om Mani Padme Hum. tu sare tu re so a om sare 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 tu sare tu re so a.
Now the children are welcome to go to their classes. If your child has never been to the center before, would you please accompany your child, fill out a survey form?
And if there's anyone who needs a seat, this whole bench is available.
See you later, guys.
Bye. Bye-bye. See you, darling. Bye.
See you, sweetheart.
Today's Sunday teaching was sponsored by Peter Murphy for the long life and happiness of Lama Zompa Rinpoche and all of our precious teachers. Today is November 11, 2012, Sunday teaching with Venerable Robino.
And the topic, what's it saying? Learning to like ugly people, isn't it? Learning to like ugly people. Learning to like the mean people. I can't see half of you back there. I'm so sorry. Maybe they should organize the chairs and have some ramp at the back so you can get up high. Because there's nothing more miserable than... Well, maybe the back of the head of the person in front of you is nice. But I can't see you. It's a pity. What to do? Okay. Well, first of all, why would we want to like difficult people? We've got to ask ourselves that question, isn't it? Why would we want to? You know, sometimes when it sounds like religion or spiritual, we think, oh, we should do it. But let's be logical. Why should we do it? What would be the... And the first step has to be, what's the benefit to me? And I don't mean this in a selfish way. You know, we really need the first step, very much the first approach in Buddhist psychology, the first is to really learn to look into our mind and see the results to me of what I'm thinking and feeling. So I think... forgetting about how horrible that person is. Let's face it, the world is full of people who are very horrible. And that's not being horrible about people. It's just a fact. If we look at the world, people do terrible things to each other. There's no question. And there's no doubt that in our lives we have people who are really mean and angry and nasty and criticize us. This is the way the world is. It's unfortunate. We have to see the reality. So the first thing here, the first thing that really is so powerful, and if we could do this already, we could make so many changes. But this is the hard part. The first thing is to really check in me how, let's say, you know, the natural response, we would assume the natural response of some mean person would be to feel hurt, to lash back at them, to criticize them behind their back, to get angry with them, to abuse them back, whatever. These are, the variations. We either say it to them or we say it to someone else. Or we feel it inside and it all burns away, it eats away at us, you know. So one of the first things to see, and this is where it's got nothing to do with being, it's not a moralistic thing, it's a practical thing. Look at the result of, to myself, of my anger, my jealousy, my fear, my resentment, when I curse and swear about that person behind their back. Look what it's doing to me. Look how it disturbs my mind. This is the first point. So it's nothing to do with feeling guilty or I shouldn't think this way or it's bad to think this way. Someone's going to punish me for thinking this way. None of that's got anything to do with it. The most practical first step in the Buddhist approach is to see the effect of our own actions, our own words, our own thoughts on ourself. And I think anybody in this room with half a brain will agree. No matter how justified we feel, because that person, that mean, ugly husband who left you for the younger version, you know, your mean child who did the terrible things to you, that horrible person at work, the next door neighbour, your old auntie. I mean, it's usually people we're close to, isn't it? Unless, of course, it's politicians. We get really mad at them. But in the end, this is the biggest point, you know. The first step, the first kind of junior school level of practice. Compassion actually is really advanced. That's like university. To really be, to do actions and say words and to have thoughts that are positive about people, especially the difficult ones, is an extremely big ask. So you can't leap to this. But the first thing is to see the pain and anguish that your own anger and your hurt, how they affect you. And I think anybody, as I said, with half a brain in this room will see that when you're angry or feeling hurt or resentful, even though you feel justified, that's the part that's heartbreaking. Now, this is what's hard to see. Because when I say to you, why are you unhappy? You know, you say to me, why are you unhappy, Robina? And I will tell you, I'll say, Fred did this, Fred said this, Fred did this to me. I will tell you the story I'll tell you the picture in my mind of that person out there, what he did. So as far as I'm concerned, that's what's happening for me. Fred said this, Fred did that. Now, that might be true, but the subtler point, and it's kind of an obvious, but it's also subtler, harder to see, is you'll say to me, no, that's fine, Robina, you're telling me about Fred. Now tell me about you. What's going on inside your mind? And I'll repeat the story. Fred did this and Fred did that. Because I can't hear the quality of my words, which is what's called anger or hurt. That's what's happening in me. It's called anger and hurt or resentment. And so because then I sit there going on for days and days and sometimes years and years, look how people never get rid of their resentments, which is how come they go crazy, you know. This is the point, because our mind's running rampant. We don't, and this is our trouble in our culture. We're not taught techniques at school. Maybe there's a bit more awareness these days, but we're just not given these techniques of how to listen to what's happening in our own head and how to slowly have the courage to change those thoughts, to change those feelings, to change those stories. Because basically it is a story. In other words, another way to put this, there's basically in our life, there's two things going on. From the time you wake up in the morning until the time you go to sleep, you could track two lots of events. The usual events we track are the outside ones. How'd you go today, Robina? Oh, had a really nice day. The light was green and Fred was kind and the kids were good and the boss was lovely and the sun was shining, you know. So what I just did was I described the outside events, didn't I? Now let's describe another set of events. How'd you go today, Robina? Oh, not bad. I practiced patience. I enjoyed the green light. I was kind to the boss. In other words, the inside events. But we mix these two up. We don't see the difference. Because we walk around life feeling like this empty vessel, like this little victim, and then things out there happen, and then that makes me think things. That's how we see the world, isn't it? Oh, the red light made me mad today. Fred was kind today. The food was tasty today. And what we do is we're tending to see that we are just like victims of these external events. And what choice do I have? You just got to be mad at a red light. How can I change my mind there, you know? But we don't even think we have a thought process. We just think the red light does it to me. Fred does it to me. The nice food does it to me. The blue sky does it to me. And I'm just this victim that has to feel happy one minute and has to feel angry the next. Isn't this how we feel? And we get pushed from pillar to post, you know, by the events of our daily life. Well, this approach here, and believe me, Buddha doesn't own this. He didn't make this up. He just runs with this approach. This is the main approach in Buddhism. And it sounds easy, but it's enormously hard. That is to start being aware of the inner events, meaning the response, even, you know, the responses to the outside events. What's arising in my mind, in other words. And this is a really intense exercise. It's an intense training to do, because like I said, we're not used to doing it. We only ever think in terms of the outside, the images in our mind. By the end of the day when we're going around like in circles in our head, it's all about she this and he that and it this and they that and they're this, all the stuff there. We know we're feeling something, and when it's really strong feelings, then we are prepared to notice it and go, I'm so anxious, I'm so angry, I'm so hurt. But we don't feel we have much power to control it all because we're not taught these techniques. This is really as simple as that, you know. And so it's a tough one. You know, let's face it, we're not five, we're halfway through our lives, if not nearly dead. We've practiced our whole lives doing this opposite one, you know, of dumping everything on the outside, looking for delicious things, pushing away the ugly things, and then wondering why we get stressed out and panic attacks and have to go, you know, get depressed and go have to get pills. It's not mysterious. It's only because we haven't paid attention to this mind, to these thoughts, to these feelings. And don't just think that's a luxury. It's absolutely vital. It's like paying attention to your computer and your garden and all your physical, you know, all our physical, like our fridge and our house and our plumbing and our car. We have maintenance. We have knowledge about how to fix things. We check for the signs when things are going wrong. So before the car collapses on the freeway and the four tyres fall off, you have some maintenance. You go to your garage. You know, you go to your guy and get it fixed. We don't have those techniques for our mind. We think it's self-indulgent. I mean, it's terrible to think this way. So in the same way we need to have proper techniques to understand our computer and our car and our garden and our kettle and our anything else so they don't collapse on us and we can predict the problems coming. I mean, it's obvious we have them. The freeways, you know, you rarely find cars broken down in the middle of the freeway because we have these techniques, but we don't have it for our own mind, you know. We don't have it for our own mind. And this is what we need so badly. Then, you know, then the job of learning to like difficult people, we can handle that one, but let's first look at dealing with us. We're the difficult one right now, you know. Struggling with my mind, so fearful, so worried, so anxious, so hurt, such low self-esteem. And I'm not criticizing us. This is the irony of ego, you know, that we think we're the worst person in the world. So we're never stopping in our own heads, racing on all day. And then, of course, when a difficult person comes along, it's like a knife in the heart. We can't possibly cope with it. So maybe we should first start coping with the nice people, coping with the good things, understanding our responses and having some courage, you know, and having techniques to help us see our mind better and then sorting ourselves out at the end of the day so you can wake up next day kind of fairly fresh instead of building it up week after month after year until you have a mental breakdown. This is first step. It's crucial. Because if we can't see what's going on in here, it isn't possible to really then see unkind, mean people out there, all the painful stuff, and deal with it nicely. But we can try, you know, we can try. So what is the approach to, you know, okay, the first approach is this one that I'm saying. The logical reason to be cautious with our thoughts and feelings in relation to the difficult people is for my sake. This is the first point. So clear, so fundamental, so necessary. Do not think that is not important. When we think of spiritual teachings and spiritual paths, we tend to dismiss me and we think, oh, I'm supposed to be compassionate to others. Yes. Buddha has this nice analogy. A bird needs two wings, wisdom and compassion. Compassion is the more advanced. Compassion is the most difficult. Compassion is finally the point where you can get it up into the wake up in life and spontaneously get out there and be useful to others. But you can't possibly do that until you learn to put yourself together, which is what they call the wisdom wing, which is what we're discussing here. This is the first step. Sort out the nuts and bolts of my own crazy mind. You know, this is absolutely vital. So then we're going to start to see in our mind, you know, using Buddhist psychological approach, a very simple kind of approach. The Buddhist psychological approach divides up the contents of our mind. It's very simple, in fact, deceptively simple. We think, oh, that can't be that easy, you know. But this is the view that Buddha's had for 2,500 years and it hasn't changed yet. So maybe people who are using it, maybe it works. That's why it hasn't changed. Possibly. Let's see. It's up to us to check it up. You know, basically we can divide the contents of our mind into two very simple categories, positive and negative. Not in a moralistic sense. These are like technical terms. And the negative ones, hey, we all know them. They're called anger, fear, jealousy, depression, low self-esteem. We know these instantly we hear those words. We know them because we've got that stuff inside us. And then the so-called positive ones, we know those too because we have them inside us as well. When we heard the word love and we didn't know what it meant, it means we haven't got it inside. So when we say the word love, compassion, we know them because they're in here. And that gives us hope. They are there. You know, so there's love, compassion, forgiveness, generosity, patience. Sometimes they're painful to do, but we know they're worthwhile. And we kind of know this intuitively. And that's why I'd say we're sitting in a room like this as opposed to the gun club or down there wanting to kill people, you know, isn't it? I mean, that's why we come to places like this, looking for some tools to help nourish the good part of us. This is why we're here, you know. How marvelous. So these words sound simple. Anger, depression, jealousy, love, compassion, forgiveness. Of course, the key is how do we lessen the neuroses and grow the good ones, which of course is the fundamental approach being in the Buddhist approach to life, you know. The technique called meditation is a technique that we use to help us look into our minds and identify these different parts of us, these different roommates in this head of ours, so we can start sorting out, you know, the stuff that's going inside us. And that's this first crucial step. So this is why starting the day with a really simple little technique of just 2 minutes even, sitting there, minding your own business for 2 minutes, closing your eyes and watching your breath go in and out. Not because your breath is holy or anything, because it's happening naturally and you can focus your mind on it. You can kind of anchor your mind to the breath so your mind doesn't go berserk all over the place, which is what it spends its life doing. At least for 2 minutes we can learn to focus the mind. Not for any magical reason, but just to get the habit of focusing, of stepping back out of the mess. And then we bring that technique to bear in our daily life. When you drive in the car, you're not just noticing the cars and the red light and anxiously anticipating getting to work and worried about being late, but you're noticing the stuff inside. And you're noticing the anxiety. You're noticing the anger. And you're learning while you're adjusting the car, you're adjusting your mind as well. That's the skill we absolutely have to develop. In the beginning, it's quite difficult because we're not used to doing it. We can drive cars beautifully. We can't drive our own mind at all. We're victims. It's like we're in a car, we can't drive. It just goes wherever the thoughts take us. Isn't it? So we have to learn to know how to drive our mind. First step is to see what's there, which is a bit scary. They all say, when they describe these techniques of how to learn to meditate, these very ancient techniques that go back like thousands of years, it's laid down in terms of 9 stages, this particular kind of concentration meditation, a very practical psychological technique. They say one of the first signs of success is you think you're getting worse. It's because, you think you're getting worse because you've never looked in your mind before. And when you start to look, of course, you're noticing the stuff that you didn't notice before. So it's a little bit scary initially. It's just like when you first go to the gym, you discover muscles you never thought you had. So you do feel that first night when you come home like as if you're worse, isn't it? But we know it's a good pain. That's the same thing here, So the crucial first step has to be to notice what's arising. So we kind of know ourselves from our life. We know, let's say, we have a tendency to get angry easily. So then that will be the obvious response to the difficult person, isn't it? Like I said, you mightn't say it in front of them, but you're going to curse them behind their back and, go tell hubby at home or your sister or something. It all comes out. So the first step here is to, and this is what's tough, because we feel so justified in having this view. We feel, and this is what we say, I'm allowed to be angry, we'll say. We say that. You look in the feeling, I'm allowed to be angry. Well, of course you are. You're allowed to do whatever you want. You're the boss, people. Buddha's not the boss. He doesn't talk like that. There's no one, as far as Buddha's concerned, there's no one up there judging, rewarding, punishing. There's no concept like that. It's this accountability that Buddha talks about. So this is a big, intense concept. I'm allowed to be angry. I'm allowed to be jealous, I say. And we desperately look for this kind of rationale to give us ourselves the seal of approval to be angry, depressed or jealous. I'm not being unkind here, but it's how we instinctively feel, We try to find a reason to hold on to that gives me permission to do it. All Buddha's saying is, I understand how you feel. Life's tough, he's saying. But sweetheart, check how it makes you feel. Just check how it makes you feel. And in a sense, what he's trying to get us to see is to have compassion for ourselves. And I'm not kidding. I mean, they don't say it like this, but this effectively is the point. And this is a massive point. This is huge. So let's just say, it is right, that horrible mean Fred. Difficult, self-centered, criticizing other people, selfish. We know people like this. You might be right. If you want to be analytical and correct, check the boxes. He did do this, he is that, he is mean, he's this, blah, blah, blah. Get your facts, it might be true. Then you leave it alone. Okay, that's Fred. Now let's look at me. Because Fred is one thing and I'm something else. Let's look at my responses now. Let's give the same analysis to my responses as we are very happy to do to Fred. We're able to give a detailed description of Fred to whoever wants to hear it. We're good at this. We're excellent at finding everyone else's fault. We're very intelligent when it comes to other people's faults. Truly, aren't we? We're excellent at it. We're the first to speak, Well, that same analysis, that same clarity, that same searching for qualities we need to apply to ourselves. And this is not out of being mean to ourselves, but out of kindness to ourselves. And this is already tough. I mean, compassion even sometimes feels easier than this. Because this demands accountability. It demands you looking into your own mind and seeing, okay, I've got this anger in there. Let's listen to the anger. What is it saying, you know? Listen to the, like this one, this crazy roommate called anger. The feeling is there, sure, the feeling, the physical. But what are the words saying? What's anger's script? He this, he said that, he did this. How dare he do that to me? I don't deserve it. It's like a very, all the neuroses are like this. They're very defensive. They're very hurt. They're very fragile, actually, coming like while we lash out to others, because our own sense of self is so fragile. It's kind of ironic. So we have to hear this. And then we have to see the obvious harm that my anger, my hurt, my rage, my resentment is doing to me. This is huge, right there, just this. So when we can begin to see this, when we can begin to own this, to be accountable for this, not criticize yourself, not beat yourself up, not be guilty, that doesn't help, but to see it first, to own it. It's like you've got this, you know, like you've got this ugly scar on your arm and you just can't stand looking at it, you know. You know it's there, but you don't want to see it, you know. You're always hiding it, always pushing it away. You've got to start looking at it. You've got to start looking at what it is so you can analyze it, so you can understand it. And then you start to see that it's not permanent. This is part of why we have so much fear about our own stuff, because we think it's permanent. We think it's going to be there forever. So, of course, you live in denial of it. You can't bear to look at that ugly scar. But when one day you start to be brave enough to go against your fear, to look at it, ugly as it is, then you can see it more clearly. Then you can start to think, it's not permanent. I can slowly get rid of it. Then you have more courage. Then you'll learn to live with that crazy roommate called anger. But every time anger rises, every time the anger, you know, the roommate shouts, pretty, you know, big bossy one, you've got this patient roommate quietly sitting there, or the, you know, the forgiving roommate and the wise roommate, the other parts of us, the brave parts of us, the kind parts of us, the good parts of us, the intelligent parts of us. They're quiet little voices now. Anger and arrogance and jealousy and depression run the show right now. They run around the house and take over everything, and the other ones are sitting underneath the bed all quiet and kind of nervous. So they've got to come out and start getting stronger. Okay? These other parts of us are in there. They've got to come out. Okay, Rabina, come on, anger. And you have to be brave to face your own anger. And wisdom and clarity and kindness, all these other bits of you, will argue with it. And see the mess that anger's causing in this head of yours. So it's like a really hard process, but so, so necessary, and takes much courage. Because we love to either defend our right to have it, or we beat ourselves mercifully for having it. We get riddled with guilt. And you know what guilt is? Guilt is another word for anger, and the object is you. You listen to the words of guilt. I did this, and I did that, and I did this, and I'm so angry, and I'm such a bad person. That's called anger. You're angry about your own anger. That's what guilt is. And you listen to anger. You did this, and you did that, and you did this, and Fred did that, and Fred did this, and Fred is a bad person. So anger and guilt are the same state of mind, but the object is different. That's all. So we have so much anger towards ourselves. It's so painful. So this is where it's tricky, you know. Anger with Fred is there, and then we feel guilty about it, or we justify it. So we've got to have this intelligent approach to the parts of ourself. That's why it's important not just to say, I am angry, like the whole of me is angry from head to toe. No, it's only one of the roommates, okay? It feels like it's running the whole house, I agree. But it's only one of the roommates. It's really important, this point. It's only one piece of you, not the whole piece of you. I am depressed, we say. It's very vivid, isn't it? I am depressed. Depression is only one part of you. We've got to be brave enough to listen to the other parts come up. Hear them, you know, they're there. It takes great courage. Then we can begin to see the pain that my anger is causing me. Then for my sake, maybe I've got to keep away from Fred if I have the luxury to do this. The very first level of Buddhist practice, it's basically telling us, helping us, Buddha's kind of exhorting us to just be cautious. Back away from the problems. This is the very first level of practice. Be cautious. Back away from the problems. Notice the foods and the things that make you greedy and grasping and stuff them into your mouth, so you maybe you avoid them. Look at the people who cause you craziness. Maybe not out of anger to them, but out of caution to protect yourself. So you control your behavior. You be cautious and you give yourself, if we can, have the luxury to do this, which is actually a sign of enormous self-respect. And you can see, by the way, we are in our relationships, where we live with each other and we go crazy, fighting every day, screaming, shouting, yelling, and wonder why we keep having problems. I mean, it's too much to ask an ordinary person to live with another ordinary person. It really is too much, and you people go and do it, you know. You even live in the same bed with each other. I don't know how you're going to handle it. I'm serious here. But give yourself some space, you know. We need space. It's like respectful to yourself. But we don't even have enough wisdom to do this. We just launch into these, you know, we just go back to the same people like a moth to a flame. It shows we have no awareness of our own mind. So we're not respecting even ourselves. How can we respect other people? The very first level is really playing safe. If you can have the luxury to avoid mean, ugly Freds, then wow, please do it. Not out of anger, but because you know you can't handle it. You know, just like, you know, no one would, listen to these words, no one would expect an alcoholic to give up attachment to alcohol while continuing to drink alcohol. Clearly insane. Well, why do you expect yourself to give up anger towards a troublesome person and you're still living with a troublesome person? It's too much to ask yourself. It's too much to ask an ordinary person. It really is. We have to be very, very wise here. So when we know certain people make me crazy, I need to have the intelligence to remove myself from them, if I can. We don't even notice this. We just go back like a moth to a flame and wonder why we fight again. Then, of course, when you're more advanced and you get to the compassion wing, then we can start starting talk about how to deal with difficult people. That's assuming you can't remove yourself from them. Simple solution in the beginning, remove yourself from them. But work on your mind. Don't just say, yeah, Fred's horrible, I don't want to look at him. That's called anger. This one is being cautious. I keep away from Fred. I know it's not Fred. I know it's my problem. It's my anger. I can't handle Fred, so I'll keep away from him. That's a good reason to keep away. The other one just increases your anger. The really important point is, it means, again, self-awareness. We've got to be aware of what's going on in our own mind and then select and have the self-dignity to choose the environments that work for us. The husband, you know, the work. If we can. It's a luxury, maybe, you know. Then you're going to have time to look at your mind. Like giving up the alcohol, now you can start to deal with your pain and your hurt and your mind. You can't do it while you're drinking alcohol. It's impossible. Same here. So then, let's assume now we've done that inner work. Let's assume we know what's good for us. Let's assume we're aware of our anger and we're being cautious. Now let's see what's it say on the title? Deal with. Okay, deal with difficult people. Well, that's the first strategy for dealing. Keep out of their way. But not out of anger. That's the crucial point. So if, let's say, you can't. This is so interesting. There's so many ways of dealing, you know. I mean, I can think of one example of a friend of mine when I was a kid. We were Catholics, right? My mum, and she had 7 children. She had a crazy, alcoholic, difficult husband, my father. And then her best friend, Sheila, who had a really difficult, crazy, alcoholic husband called Reg. And my father and Reg would hang out at the races, and Reg was, what do they call it in Australia? There's a kind of they call them a bookie, meaning, you know, the bookies on the races, but illegal one. And there's a huge network of these illegal bookies, you know. So Reg was a bookie, and my father would, you know, spend all the family money on the horses and lose, of course. And they drink together. They were like a really good pair. So they were mates, and then my mum and Sheila were mates, and they were both Catholics, and Sheila was just this very funny, hilarious person. She was as skinny as a rake, this working class lady, really skinny. She'd smoke about 80 cigarettes a day and live on bread and butter and tea. You know, that's about all she lived on. But she had enormous faith in God. She was an amazing person. She really believed that God was in everybody and God was in Reg. So Reg was this creep, I can't tell you. I mean, I love Reg, okay, he's dead now. But Reg was mean and ugly and arrogant, you can't imagine, would be ruthless with her and treat her terribly. But for Sheila, it was water off a duck's back. This was her way of dealing with difficult people, because she believed that God was in Reg, God loved Reg, so why shouldn't Sheila love Reg? So therefore, you know what? Sheila didn't suffer. Not a fraction. Maybe these days, psychologically, we'll say she was living in denial. I don't think so. I know as a kid, I loved going over to her house. Okay, she had five boys, that's maybe one reason. But I think the other reason was because if she had been a miserable, depressed, angry person, believe me, I wouldn't have wanted to be anywhere near her. But she was funny and would laugh and smile and love you and hug you and praise you. I loved being around her. So she clearly wasn't being a neurotic, you know, because kids kind of have a real radar for that. I loved being around Sheila. She was hilarious. So that was her way of dealing with difficult people. That was pretty powerful. Now, using a Buddhist example of this, a friend of mine now, a Buddhist in Melbourne, both of them in Melbourne, her husband's an alcoholic, but he's a quiet alcoholic. He drinks himself at night after his job. He's not harming anybody but himself. He's drinking himself to death, basically. So he wouldn't be a fun partner to be around, would he? But years ago, she made the decision that this is the way he is, and she knew that he would be dead without her. So she made a decision based on compassion, but self-preservation as well, that it was right for her to continue to live with him, but she stopped trying to change him. She stopped thinking he shouldn't be this way and how dare he be this way and talk about him to her sisters and everybody else, which is where all the fuss and bother happens. She can't change him, but she loves him for who he is, and so she doesn't suffer. She has her own life. She goes to her own retreat. She has her own things. She doesn't suffer. Now, this is a brave attitude. This is the most advanced, the attitude those two had. So we look at our usual one. We're caught up in our own dramas and our own needs, our own anger. So we're angry with the person, we criticize them, we fight with them, we want them to be different. We talk about them behind their back. That's why all the fuss, that's why all the dramas, you know. And that's what anger is. Anger, and you know what anger is? It's anger is the response when our attachment doesn't get what it wants. And this word attachment, which is sort of cute, the way we use it in our culture, but in Buddhism, it's this really deeply ingrained, constant craving to get what I want every single second. And it's like panic-stricken. It's a very deep ingrained, instinctive, panic-driven need to get what I want every second. And anger is the response when it doesn't get what it wants. Now, if we see these two working in our lives, we can see this is the reason we freak out, the reason we have fights, the reason we get upset. But they're quite deep inside us. And in our culture, psychologically, we just think they're normal behavior. Well, Buddha says they're mental illnesses, you know, and we can learn to change them. So they are the ones that cause the problem, because yes, indeed, Fred is difficult. Reg is difficult. My father was difficult. That's true. They were. Now, those two women chose to stay in the problem because they could handle it. Now, if you're one of the people who can't do that, then best for you to move. Because our problem is we have the lousy, you know, alcoholic husband or uncle or son or whatever it is, but we can't bear it. We can't bear it. Our attachment can't bear it. So then we get angry with them and we think we're justified in getting angry because he is this and he did that and he said this and he is this, and we never give up on it. But we continue to run back home every time to him. So we've got to make some choices, you know. We've got to make some decisions. Like my friend Sheila, my other friend. They made decisions that this is how it is. I can't change it. And they gave themselves valid reasons for being there that caused them not to suffer from it. Pretty incredible, in my opinion. Pretty amazing. So if we can't do that, then we've got to really make some decisions. And this is the point. They made decisions. They made choices. And their choice was to stay there and to change their minds. Another choice might be, I can't bear it. Well, if you can't bear it, but you're going to keep going back and fighting and yelling and screaming, then you've got to make a choice to go. And I'm not joking here. Because if you're going to stay, and many of us will say, oh, I can't leave. Well, if you can't leave, you need to make some choices about that. And this is what's hard. You need to say, if you really mean I can't leave, then you've got to change your mind. You don't have a choice about it, because you can't keep living in that situation, saying you can't leave, feeling you haven't got a choice, but then keeping fighting and keeping being angry and keeping being upset and jealous and depressed. This is what makes us mad. We go mad, literally. You've got to make a decision. We've got to be accountable. So the decision might be to go if you can't cope with it. And if you can have enough courage to cope with it, like they did, then you will become happy. It's a really tough call, but it really, and this is where this process of being responsible for ourselves demands enormous integrity, enormous courage. And this is our problem. Most of us, we stay in the miserable problem, we stay in the lousy job, we stay around the lousy next door neighbour, we stay around the lousy husband, and we just keep going on and on and on about it, and then continue to blame them, but not making the decision to move away or to change our mind. Because there are two options: move away or change your mind. You analyse it, you can't see another option, you know. But all we try to do is wish they were different, and how dare they be this way, and why are they this way, and they shouldn't be this way. You might be right, but what good is that? I remember two examples, you know, as you know maybe, I worked with people in prison for many years. And two examples. This one woman, I didn't meet her, but I read her book. She was an amazing woman. She was accused of murdering three people. She was on death row in Florida for 17 years. She was completely innocent and finally got out, okay? Then, and I read recently another book of hers, a later one, about her. She got married to some old Irish guy who'd been in prison for years too, and the suffering was intense. She had three small children. She lost all her children. They were given away. Her husband was executed for this murder. He never did as well. Then eventually the people who did it confessed and she was taken out of prison. But what was interesting was her way of dealing with it. She was one of those people who didn't have much anger, which I think is so miraculous. Some people just don't have much anger, you know. But her way of dealing with the suffering was, and this is what patience is. Patience isn't some kind of gritting your teeth and frustratedly waiting for that thing to change. Patience is really a very courageous state of mind that confronts this terrible thing, the mean, ugly husband, imprisonment, or whatever, can sees it, walks into it, confronts it. This is what it is. This is what it is. Not, it shouldn't be this way, and why is it this way, and how dare it be this way, and if only it weren't this way, and it shouldn't be. This is the voice of anger. The voice of patience is, but Rabina, this is the way it is. Now let's see what I can do about it. Not just shout and yell and rant and rave, which is what anger does. So that's what she did. And she said, I couldn't change the minds of the prosecutors, the judge, the accusers, the jury. I couldn't change my cell. I couldn't open that door. But they couldn't take my mind from me. So she started to do meditation. She did yoga. So it was painful 17 years, devastating. But she came out a stronger, wiser, more marvelous person because she had to accept that situation. And she changed her mind instead. The other example, another guy I read about on death row who was innocent, but he would just, I mean, this is understandable, rage continuously, scream as long as he could until he went completely mad. I did not rape and kill whoever it was, you know, day after week after month after year until he went completely out of his brain. Now, the fact is, they were the situation. It was wrong. They were innocent. But this was the reality. One could not cope with it, which is the one with anger, which is join the club. And the other one could cope. It's so painful. It's so painful. But this is life. And we do have the power to change our minds. We do have the courage. And often, like our friends in prison who became Buddhist, often their mantra was, this is my wake-up call. So sometimes when the bad things happen, it is the perfect opportunity to really make some choices. Not just go on the same old plan, going crazy, being a victim, blaming everybody else, because that is what makes us mad. We can change our minds, you know. It's so painful, but we do have the power. And when we do, that's when we feel good. That's when we feel powerful, when we can change our minds. What do you think? Do you want to ask me some questions? It's typical, isn't it? Scary as hell. And everybody in this room, I know we all are speaking, you know what I'm saying. Not because I can see, you know, you think I'm talking about you probably. But I'm talking about me. We're all the same, you know. We're all the same. This is common. This is universal. So any questions, anyone? Or comments or anything?
Your mother was able to make a decision and stay with your father.
Well,
but you didn't have a choice.
No, okay. But first of all, my mother didn't make a decision. She just she was miserable and depressed and angry and hurt all the whole time. My mother's friend.
Oh, it was Sheila.
Sheila, yeah. So me, I didn't, because a child, that's right, I didn't.
You didn't have a choice.
That's right, I didn't. It was my daddy, that's right, and my mother.
So how did you cope?
Well, that's it, isn't it? I mean, I think if I look back, I didn't cope very well. We didn't, all of us, well, seven of us all had our own crazy ways of dealing with this scenario, you know. But I think, when I look back, and I'm just fortunate, I suppose, I was pretty angry. I've got angry nature. But one of the things I do see in myself since little girl, and I think I was very fortunate having this, I was able to see that my father was suffering. Even though the things he did to me, it doesn't matter the details, were inappropriate, totally inappropriate for a father, but I always could see he was suffering. And I think I'm fortunate that way. That's probably what helped me stay sane, you know? I really think so. I didn't ever feel so victimized by it. And that's just my personality. I mean, some of my other sisters dealt in different ways, you know. Three of them had mental breakdowns. One of them, you know, just everyone dealt in their own way. And I think that's where I think it's quite difficult if you are that child and no one to turn to. You've got nothing but your own inner resources. And if you don't have those resources, that's tragic, isn't it? Nothing much you can do as a child. Some children have these resources, you know, and can deal with it and then can grow from it as you get older. And that's something I think with all of this, I look back at my family, we're all, you know, old now, the seven of us. Every one of us in our own way have found resources in us, and every one of us has been able to move forward in our lives and be forgiving and loving, and that's very fortunate. Some people never find that part of themselves, do they? Do you understand what I'm saying? It's really true, isn't it? Yes.
What about obligation?
Say that again.
What about obligation?
So say a little bit, unpack it a bit for me.
What I mean by that is someone wants you there.
You mean a particular relationship and you have an obligation, duty. Oh, I think it's a very, it could be, I think it's, okay, my feeling is some people see that, but often perhaps the bigger one is their fear and they're saying that one. But if it genuinely is your obligation, like my other friend, the Buddhist one, who made that decision, she really felt it was the right thing for the sake of the other person. She was able to be strong from it. So if we really do that, own it. But often what happens is you do it out of obligation, but you feel victimized and you end up being miserable still. So if you're really going to choose it, really choose it, and the power comes from the choice. This is my choice. This is a horrible situation, but I'm choosing it. I think that's the point I'm making, to really choose it. But much of the time we say it's obligation, we're feeling a victim of it. And that's where the suffering is. That's a disaster. You know what I'm saying? And because it often, and often it's fear to change.
And that also creates resentment.
Oh, and that's the point.
And
that's
anger,
where,
and once again goes back to anger.
That's the whole point. Exactly. That's exactly. So to really choose that situation, okay, I really feel I'm going to do this for the sake of the kids. And that's very noble, actually. It's incredible. Very hard to do. Most people don't do it. They either stay because they're afraid to leave, and then they blame the other person. Or they say, I can't leave because it's obligation, but they still keep blaming. So to really say it's obligation is pretty powerful. Then you will be happy because you've made that choice with real power.
Right, because what I find is that I need to protect myself.
Yes.
This is about self-preservation.
Absolutely.
And I can't worry about the other person's feelings, nor their emotions, necessarily. I mean, not to be...
No, that's right. This is this first level. If
right.
We need to first see what's good and not good for me, because if I'm going to be in danger territory and end up murdering somebody, I've got to watch myself and protect myself. You've got to first do it for your sake, but in a good way. That's right. And when you can be brave enough, you can even do it for their sake. That's the more advanced level. First yourself, there's no doubt about it. Be cautious and know what conditions you need to be a reasonable person. And even if you upset the other person, you can't help that. It's true. And that takes courage as well, because we're so scared of what other people think. And then again, the resentment comes. You know? Yeah. Yes, down here.
I find for me it's more difficult to deal with loved ones who are falling apart.
Yes.
And lonely.
Yes.
And I'd like to learn how to ease another person's burden.
Okay. That's a really good point, because I think this is where this business first of our own looking at ourselves first and looking at this deep sense of attachment and neediness to have everything nice. We can't. It's very hard for us to see that because we mix it with compassion. We do want things to be nice. All you want is your loved ones to be happy, right? But what we've got to see too here is quite hard is our own neediness for our sake for them to be happy, which often is what gives us no courage to bear their suffering, which is often why when we try to help others, it's mixed with our attachment, and so we end up interfering and not really helping them because we're desperate that they change because we can't bear it. That part's hard to see in us. But if we look at the genuine part of us, which is how you're talking hopefully, the genuine wish to help others, the point is sometimes you can do nothing. Like my friend who decided to stay with her husband. Not Sheila, but my other Buddhist friend. She made a decision. She couldn't change him. She couldn't help him except to simply live in the house with him. But not try to change him. And that's what takes courage. And in other words, there might be a person who is sad. And if you can't, so okay, I'm saying different things here. Sometimes what I'm saying is there's nothing much you can do, and it's to have the courage to bear that and accept that and not patronize them and not try to make them different all the time and stop giving them advice. Just love them for who they are. That's one piece of advice. Do you hear this point that I'm making or not? You know, often we are so desperate that they change and we talk about them to other people and we wish they would be different. But that's often just my attachment. Sometimes the most respectful thing you can do to a person is simply accept their sadness, accept their depression, accept their alcoholism and love them for who they are and treat them with respect. Are you hearing this point? This is one point. This is one point. And this is a huge point already. Because you know yourself, when people are always in your face telling you what to do and you should do this and giving you advice when you haven't even asked for it. Because sometimes we can be a bit overbearing with each other in our wish to help each other. But often it's coming from our own attachment and our own fears. This is one point I want to say. Now, to actually try to help a person with their mind, you can't move one inch until you know about your mind. So this is why the wisdom wing first. You've got to be aware of your mind and your fears and your suffering and your unhappiness because that gives you the skill to know yourself. Then you can have the wisdom to see this other person and recognize what they're talking about. And then maybe there's something in you from your experience you can give your piece of advice. But much of the time, there's not much we can do except to love the person and be there for them and not constantly want them to be different. That takes courage. Are you seeing my point? And then give the person the respect and the space to change or to use your help when they need it. And that means not, you see, we either have two extremes in our life. We're either in each other's faces the whole time trying to change each other, and then or we just give up and don't care. But this one is looking like you're being more objective, not sticking your nose in every minute, but watching like a hawk every moment. And then looking for opportunities when you see that they can use your help or need you, you'll be there for them. It's a much more wise, more skillful way to help people. Do you understand? And I think the key thing here is we've got to look at our own enormous attachment to having everything nice. That's why from my point of view, our point of view, we can't bear someone else's suffering. It's too painful for us. And that makes us then make a mess of it. You see the point I'm saying? It's a lot of wisdom. And never stop having the wish to help others. Never stop. That's the main one. Yeah, back there. There you go. Talk to me.
This is just an observation, an insight that I have from having taken other languages. In English, we would say, I am hungry. Other languages, it would translate literally to, I have hunger. And you can apply the same thing toward anger.
That's very interesting.
I am angry versus I have anger.
No, that's a very, very good point, actually. It's true because the words are very powerful, aren't they? What language would say, I have anger? I have hunger.
Spanish, for one.
Yes. There you go. Very skillful, isn't it? That's really excellent. We should do some surveys among French people and Spanish if they have less anger or something. Or they identify with it less. How interesting. That's a very good point. Because it's true, you think of the roommates thing, because there are all these crazy roommates in there, you know? And they're all just equal, sort of all got their own little part of you. Anger is not the whole one, you know? That's right, exactly. It's a very powerful point, actually. Thank you. Someone else? Yes, over here.
Yeah, it's not a question. It's just a comment.
Okay, good.
About language. I was taking Swahili classes.
Say it again.
I was taking Swahili lessons.
Yes.
And in Swahili, they have dozens of greetings.
Greetings?
Yeah, but none of them would say anything negative.
Okay.
Like when you say, you know, how are you doing? I'm tired. That's not allowed. And
very interesting.
And the American
so what would
people,
they say?
Good.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And the American people that were taking the lessons couldn't comprehend.
Yes.
And they could not comprehend that when somebody asks you how you're doing,
you say you're
that you would
not.
Say something negative.
There you go.
How and it was this awkward
yes.
clash of cultures that
yeah. How interesting.
They didn't get it or they didn't get it.
No, I hear you. That's very
and
interesting.
And finally somebody said, how about if I'm really, really tired?
Yeah.
And the Swahili teacher thought, well, what you say, I'm doing good, but I'm also tired.
Okay, you say something positive first.
First. And if you have to, then you
yep.
say something negative.
That's
but
very interesting.
That's non-existent.
And I think, you know, if I were, just, yeah, that's interesting. Because using, say, the Buddhist take on it, which just sounds like common sense, it's sort of like respectful to others, for a start, isn't it? It's respectful to others. And if you think about it, the Buddhist, keep it there for a moment, okay. The Buddhist view, if you think about words, this is a really good point, actually, thank you. If you think about words, okay, we all talk to ourselves, right? But we know we don't need to speak it out loud. We can just say it in our head. We can hear it, isn't it? So actually the function of words is for other people's sake, isn't it? But I think our problem when we have so much ego and so much neurosis and so much self-pity and so much fear and panic, because we have no sense of any respect for ourselves, we are desperate to vomit out everything we feel for someone else to hear it. Because it's like we don't think it's real until someone else hears it. So you watch when we have bad emotions. You're already in your head telling somebody. You've got to ring someone up and tell them. So it's sort of like we need everybody to be our therapist. And that's okay, but that's where we're at. Whereas if you really think of your function of words, they're only for the sake of the person who's hearing it. And so, excuse me, it's very polite and appropriate to say, I'm doing really well, how are you? It's perfect. Keep it to yourself, please. And this is a really good practice. They talk in Buddhism about being your own therapist. Keep your problems to yourself until it's appropriate to speak them out. It's a great training, actually. I think it's very, very, very dignified. Very nice. I like that. But it's hard to do because we're desperate to blur, you know. Even if they don't ask us, we're going to be out the mouth, you know. Which shows really how we have such little self-respect because we don't think we can handle our own thoughts. We have to give them to someone else. It's like a little child. As soon as something goes wrong, she runs to mommy, mommy, you know. We've got to grow up. We're nearly dead. We better grow up. Who else has got the mic? Where else is there? Somebody? Something else, people?
Mm. So I've heard from many different sources that the energy of anger and the energy of motivation are the same.
I think it's a good point. I think it's a very good point.
And so, what you do with that energy.
Let's look at it then. Now, I can see that with myself. Having, since tiny, and, you know, what I wanted came out my mouth. I didn't hold back, you know. There's no doubt. There's just no doubt. It was very clear to me. But as I've tried to, you know, walk on my mind a bit, being a Buddhist, I can really see clearly the same, it's action energy. You look at a person who's anger, how dare this? You do this, and you're going to stick your nose in and you're going to make it better. Well, you take that part, but without the anger. I remember Martin Luther King saying, it's all right to be angry, but then you say, what can I do about it? That's when it turns into anger, into action. But if it's just anger, then you're sitting there being frustrated, and you just beat and smash and kick. But if it's channeled, because we've got to see the world as a suffering place, you've got to see if things are bad. You've got to see that, you know, the kitchen's dirty or the house is rough. You say, look at this ridiculous kitchen. But you don't just curse and say, who's going to fix it? You say, I'm going to fix it. That turns it into action and it stops becoming critical of others. So that is the way to channel it. Because that's true. You look at angry, you look at passive people, you look at patient people. They are really nice to be around, but they're very passive. They'll put up with things. They won't change. They won't be bothered. They're kind of lazy. I'm not being horrible. But we've got these two sides of ourselves. So the patient people have to be more proactive and the angry people have to be more patient but also keep the action part. Keep the action part. That I can see very clearly. It's a really important part. In Buddhist psychology, the more sophisticated levels, they talk like this. That there's the good in all of that bad, but we have to extract it. But the only way we can do that is by knowing our minds very deeply first. Because it's very too dangerous otherwise. You see what I'm saying? Yeah. Good point. Thank you. So there's hope for angry people. It's okay. Turn it into action. And this is the point. Dalai Lama said one time in an interview, one person asked him, he said, the interviewer said, but you can see the benefit of anger. It makes you do things. And the Dalai Lama said, I know what you mean. But he said, when it's just anger, it doesn't last. But if it's compassion, you never give up. So to have that action energy, to see the suffering, to see the racism, the sexism, the thisism, the thatism, whatever it might be, it's terrible. But what can I do to make it better? Because I want to make the world a better place. You turn it into compassion. Then it's really powerful. But it takes courage to do that. Because we love to criticize. We love to criticize. Isn't it? Yeah. Speak on. Yep.
Hello. Hi. I had a question, but it was more like a kind of a to say something that I've learned along the way.
Good, go on.
I'm from South Florida.
Uh-huh.
So basically, I had a job where I would work with a lot of people, and you have to do different exams and everything.
Yeah.
Very fast, uh-huh. Or in an efficient way. So I was very fast, and they said, "You're so fast. We think you could do this by yourself." So my partner was let go. So I just kept doing that for a year, and I ended up being very, very, very fast and efficient, and I broke a record of doing the most things in
That's
one
right.
day from
yep.
since they opened. So one person told me, even though I was very fast, the door was cracked, and somebody said, when I came out, they said, I noticed that out of all everywhere I've been, I've never seen somebody actually show like genuine help. In what I do, because some people, they say most of the time people are very cold.
I'm missing that last point.
Oh.
So there you were being really good at your job.
Yeah, and it's part of healthcare.
Okay.
So I was very fast, and one time I just left the door open while somebody was waiting.
Yes.
And they happened to just observe how I talked and how I cared and covered the person if they were cold. And they said, "I've been in many places and I've noticed that you are genuinely giving help."
Okay, I see.
Even though you're fast.
I get it. So then?
So then,
yep.
One time then, shortly after, I was so fast that actually it was too fast. Nothing bad happened, but somebody got inconvenienced and said, that's like very fast. That was like pretty quick. I mean, I didn't feel like you were giving me that care.
I see. Okay,
so,
then.
Because my speed, we were, more busy. They said, you can handle more. So,
I see.
I did it for 2 years.
Right.
Then? I said, "Well, I think I want to move somewhere else, north or somewhere." So what I did was got with somebody this agency is where they send you to all 50 states.
I understand.
So the thing is this, I learned to adapt well with my coworkers there, but in my mind I said, okay, that's just too much, I'm getting too much. And I had a comfortable schedule, everything was set.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking, okay, well, I have a lot of things I'm doing. And when I moved, the point of the story was that every 3 months I have to move.
Yeah.
And I was going to a Carampa Center down in Orlando.
Yeah.
And I started going there 4 months before I did the first move.
Uh-huh.
So every 3 months I would have to adapt to new people. And I learned from every three months, here to Kansas, everywhere.
That's
and
right. So then?
Then I started noticing this. Where I go, people would say, first introduction would be, "Oh, this is a new person. He's here to take my job." And then I'm like, "Oh, okay." Well, then I wouldn't think anything of it, and I would just go and do my job. So the reason why I was chosen is because I can adapt. That's what they told me. They said, "You did a lot of things. You adapted. We need somebody who can adapt right away."
That's right. So what's the conclusion here? What's the question or the point?
Well, the point is, with so much moving around, I learned that you still. I was trying to get away from change, but I went to more change. Now I'm settling to a big place where I'm going to be like a regional person.
I see.
So with meeting different people, sometimes I notice that some people have their arms open to you to learn from you.
Yes.
Or sometimes some people, they think, okay, well, are you here for my job? You just get that feeling.
Right.
So
sure.
I don't want to just stop being the way I am. Like the way, if you can tell, I like to talk.
Yeah, right.
And I want to show, but I also then sometimes I feel like if I'm too open, will that be somebody trying to take advantage of me?
Well, I can't get the essence in here. What's the essence of this?
The essence
about you?
Is
what's the learning for you from this?
Well, I learned that, I learned now that, to adapt since I've been traveling.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter, I can go from here to the Philippines.
Sure.
I'm going to have to adapt anyway,
sure.
So now I'm going to settle in one spot.
Right.
But my other question is, with people,
yes.
should I have, sometimes I have that insecurity thinking, okay, well, they might take advantage if I'm open.
Okay, the key thing here, it seems to me then, is there you are coming with your skills and your wisdom and your kindness, but if you're coming, you know, it means awareness of where someone else is coming from. We can't be so caught up in what we think we are and what we're doing and what we want to show people. It's to have awareness of another person, which is what you're doing in your job anyway, but including other people, to notice their insecurities and their fears and their seeing you as a threat. When you're aware of that, you can help alleviate their doubts and their fears, and you can win them over, isn't it? That's just being kind. It's called kindness to others.
Yes, and I've noticed that I really haven't changed the way I am.
You haven't?
Not really. The one thing I have changed is I've learned to talk less.
Have you? Well done.
Yes.
Well, I'm glad you've learned to talk less.
But I am aware of that. So.
Well, that was 7 minutes. I happened to see when I looked up it was 33. And now that's 7:40. That's 41. So that's 7 minutes. Is that good? Is that progress? Well done. Now, 9. That was 9 minutes. You talk for 9 minutes. Not bad. Thank you. So I hope you got something from that. And I hope we did too. Thank you. I think I'm past my time. Unless there's any urgent questions. Any more urgent questions?
I had a question.
Any more 9 minute points? Come on.
Huh? You know when you talked about the people vomiting out?
And yeah. Us. So I don't say people, I say us. Yes, we're all in the same boat, babe.
So the longer I practice, I find the less I actually talk.
Okay.
And sometimes when all that spewing is coming out and someone's angry with me,
yes,
and I stay very quiet, I'm often left feeling I didn't have a voice.
No, I know. See, this is, I think, it's sort of like when you start doing a new job. Like you start to drive a car for the first time, you're a bit all over the place. You can't do it right every time. When we start doing this new job, maybe, of looking into our minds, inevitably we're going to go a bit quiet, not vomit out, but maybe we go a bit extreme, and because we're not quite used to where the gears are and where the brakes are yet. So you just got to keep going and keep going until you're more natural about it, and then you'll have a voice when you feel, rather than just, oh, I'm going to be patient and listen to what they have to say. You know, you'll have enough courage to butt in if you needed to. Do you understand my point? You're just getting used to a new job, so be patient, keep going, and don't get too caught up in it, and we can't get everything perfect first. Do you see my point? Yeah. Well, enough. What do you think? I talk fast, so you got plenty of, you know. Okay. So then, good enough. We'll do our little. Is that the mic? No, we're done. We're finished. Huh? What? Where? What? Give the person. Give us the mic. Who's that? Wendy. Hi, Wendy. Hi, darling. Talk to me.
Hey, Bina. I find that even after very difficult situations, when I have worked with them through my mind for quite a while, even years, still when I remember them, I'm terribly hurt.
Yes.
And still writhing with humiliation, etc.
It's hard.
Even though I have tried very hard to move my mind into the dark track.
No.
Does it ever really change?
I think it goes. I think it has to, Wendy. I think
if
it
takes changed, time. It wouldn't be there. But it's still there.
Well, I think it just maybe
the hurt is still there.
Okay. So I think what I learned from that is that part of the pain is the expectation that it shouldn't be there. But if we accept that it is there, that means we haven't done enough work yet. So we just keep going and we learn to live with it. It's okay. Not even not done enough work yet. I just think sometimes it's just like that and we learn to live with it. It's one of the roommates. We learn to live there with them and that's all we can do. But don't have an expectation that we should be better than we are. That's very cruel to ourselves, I think. I think it takes time.
So just accept and
I think
on
let that roommate be there and give it a hug every now and again.
Thank you.
Okay. Let's do the prayers. More prayers, more thoughts, more positive thoughts. Okay.
So if you turn to the white prayer book, read the dedication verses on the pink sheet and the long life prayers. But before we do, I'd like to read the prayer list. I haven't read it in a long time. Prayers for happy rebirth. All those killed by natural and man-made disasters. All the Tibetans who have been killed or have taken their own lives in the struggle for religious freedom. Andrew Bartley, Tim Castaneda, Kim Duong's mother, Mary Honeybrink, Judy Hurley, Francis Katz, Dolores Lamancusa, Bob Milliken, Isabel the Cat, Ninja the Cat, Scott. Skynard the Cat. Job search. Evi Hara, Beth Andrew, Gary Kane, Daniel Cunningham, Harish Farma, Jenny First, Michael Folks, Kate Harvey, Andrea Johnson, Lindsay McGrath, Brian Miller, Catherine Myers, April Rocker, Tony Sloan, Rochelle Thompson, Lori Todd, SS, Anadine Silver, and Sarah. Difficulties of body and her mind. Venerable Lama Zopa Rinpoche, who is manifesting health difficulties based on our karma. Venerable Churchila, all those harmed by natural and man-made disasters. For the Tibetan people and for the Chinese authorities, may the nonviolent path lead to full reconciliation and religious freedom. Clem William Akins III, Denise Allen, Jim Barnes, A.J. Bartley's family, Bill Burke, Ron Burroughs and family, Victoria Easterday Clark, Hester Clifford, Allegra Dahlquist, Larry Davis, Jack Doger, Carrie First, Mildred Gooch, Barb and Fred Harris, Davis Helton, Lola Hilliard, Lola Hook, Mary Honeybrink's family, Leslie and Joan Inman, Kenny Jackson, Buddy Andrew Johnson, Suggy Jones, Helen Kasanoff, Francis Katz's family, Arthur Katz, Ryan Latches and his family, Mary Langstrang, Shanti and Kurt Latimer, Aunt Lori, Alyssa Luck, Carolyn and Granger Marley, Bobby Martin, Davis McCallan, Eileen McIntyre, Bao Nyo, J. Pandya, Lively Pasquale, Birgit Patty, Catherine Paul, Howard Perry, Mary Peterson, Aunt Polly, Serenoa Quinlan and her family, Duncan Quinn, Richard Robson, Rubin family, Paula Sable, Albert Sants, Greg Shario, Rosemary Cease, Mamie Stark, David Underwood, Claudia and Vic Williams, Suzanne Williams, Judith Wormser, Casey the dog, Fabio the dog, Mikey the dog, Skippy the dog. If you have any names you'd like to add, would you please say them now? May all beings everywhere, plagued by sufferings of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. May those whose bodies are worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, the hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness, and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvests. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be free. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All powerful Chenre Zigtenzen Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. Savior of the snow land teachings and transmigratory beings, who extensively clarifies the path that unifies emptiness and compassion, to the lotus in the hand, Lord Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech, may all your holy wishes be fulfilled. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatara, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. You uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjunath's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. Avalokiteshvara, great treasure of non-objectifying compassion, Manjushri, master of stainless wisdom, Tsongkhapa, crown jewel of the sages of the land of snows, to Losangdrapa, at your feet I make request. And then seven green Taras mantras. Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha. 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 Om Tare Tu Tare Tu Re Soha.